welcome to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. In the 1950s, suburban living was touted as a way to escape the hustle and bustle and the dangers of urban life. Now, researchers tell us that the sprawling roadways of suburbia may be home to higher rates of obesity, diabetes, and heart disease. A new study published in the Journal of Transport and Health suggests that city living, on the other hand, could improve your health. Joining us now is one of the authors of that study, University of Connecticut, civil engineering professor Dr. Norman Garrick. Welcome to the show.
Good morning, Anne. It's nice to be here.
How do we know that healthier people aren't just attracted to urban living and the opposite is true for suburban living?
Well, we have not done anything. We have not been able to show that. That might well be the case. I think it's unlikely, but our study does not show that that definitively.
How did you conduct the study? What were you looking for?
What we did was we've been actually studying these cities for about 8 years. We started out looking at differences in accident experience, traffic accident experiences in different places. And what we found initially was that older cities had much lower rates of traffic fatality for all types of road users. And that was the start. One of the things we were trying to understand is what were some of the design factors that resulted in this outcome. And what this led us to was the finding that how cities were laid out, the type of street patterns, what seems to be what was correlated with this difference in traffic fatalities.
And when you talk about cities, are you talking about city centers or cities in general, the cities and the city bound, everything within the city boundaries?
Well, it's no, actually, those terms are thrown around in very loose ways.
Right.
What we did actually, were we looked at cities in California that that were about 100,000 people. We wanted to keep the cities to relatively small cities so that we could actually collect the data. So these were mostly standalone towns. Some of them were in metropolitan areas.
And so you found that there were fewer traffic accidents, I guess, per capita or something like that for city dwellers than there were for suburban dwellers. What else did you find?
We then went on to look to see how people traveled. And what we found in a lot of these cities was that in the older cities, people also drove much less. They took transit more. They walked more. And they took the bike and took their bikes more. And so this is what led to our latest study.
And that has to do with why suburban living makes us less healthy.
Yes, exactly. There has been a long history of research looking at what is referred to as active transportation and how that might or might not affect health outcomes.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. It is Wellness Wednesday. My guest is Dr. Norman Garrick. He's a Connecticut civil engineering professor and one of the authors of a study that suggests that city living could improve your health. Do you live in the suburbs now? Have you moved to the city? Give us a call and tell us about your experience and how you move around in the city compared to how you used to move around as a suburban dweller. 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. So what is it about suburban living that makes us less healthy?
Well, in the 50s, as you said, we were touting suburban living. But what we ended up doing was building places where walking, biking, getting around on foot was basically engineered out of daily life. So we built places that were connected to each other by huge arterial roads. And then the communities themselves were built in pods. So we had residential pods, we had commercial pods, we had the school out way out on the edge of the city. So it was really difficult to walk and also dangerous to walk. So it ended up that we were building places that encouraged people to drive everywhere for everything.
And that had an effect on our mass transportation systems too, right?
It was a disaster for mass transit. So a lot of cities, in addition to the fact that we were building these places out on the edges, we were also defunding mass transit. So you had a kind of a two-headed sword that was attacking or dismantling how we lived prior to 1950.
You referred to how the U.S. should model their cities after those in European countries. Did the same phenomena take place in Europe as it did in the United States in the 1950s?
Oh, yes, most definitely. Almost everywhere on the continent, there were a lot of places that were outliers. The difference between the U.S. and America is not one of, it's one of scale. They did not go to the same extreme that we did, but you saw exactly the same patterns. But also what is interesting is that the cities that we, you know, people admire, like Amsterdam, Zurich, and places like that, they actually went in a different direction. And you can see in 1960, in 1970, when they made the choice to stop the suburbanization of those cities and to reverse and started promoting transit in the case of Zurich or biking in the case of Amsterdam and Copenhagen.
And this was a very conscious change.
It was very conscious. There is actually an excellent book that talks about this. It's called The City of Bikes. This is relating to the experience in Amsterdam, and it talks about some of the riots that they had in Amsterdam against what the city was trying to do to make it more car-friendly.
Because people wanted to ride their bikes.
People saw the importance of bikes, and they saw the connections to different aspects of life, not just... It was not just a question of how you got around, but it was a question of how the city functioned and their relationship to their city.
So how would the U.S. at this stage of the game change to model more the European approach?
Well, we're seeing some of these changes taking place. I don't know Columbus, but I've heard of the revitalization of the city. And you're seeing that all over the country, but in places where people are making those conscious decisions to promote the city, to promote city life, to also support the kind of suburban life that is more walkable, that is more compact.
Right. They're changing the suburbs, too, now.
Exactly. And for us as engineers, what we're concerned with is that there are so many codes and regulations that are geared towards creating auto-oriented places.
Like and what? Can you give me an example?
Well, for example, in engineering schools, we don't teach students how to design street networks. It's just something that has been written out of the curriculum. So what ends up happening is that street networks get developed almost by default. So the state lays out an arterial, and then a developer comes and proposes a cul-de-sac development somewhere. So you have a very dysfunctional pattern of developing place.
I'm surprised, Norman Gehrig, that they don't teach that anymore in engineering school. That seems ridiculous. Where else would you learn the alternatives?
Well, I went to Purdue, and none of this was on the curriculum.
Wow.
I got my PhD at Purdue, and I can say that even 30 years later, there are very, very, very few places where, in fact, the only place you'll probably get to see some of these conversations is in planning school, not in engineering school anywhere in the country.
Or a history class.
Possibly.
Maybe, maybe not. If you live in the suburbs now, or if you've moved to the city, give us a call and tell us what you think about what Dr. Norman Gehrig is talking about. 614-292-8513. These changes are happening. You said they're revitalizing the downtown, but what is your sense about whether or not the United States and city planners in the U.S. have waited too long, that we rely so much on cars, not only as our primary transportation, but as a huge economic driver in this country?
Well, I think in some ways it's not too late. And in what is happening is really interesting. Over the last 10 years, car use is actually going down in the U.S. Car travel peaked on a per capita basis in 2004. And it has not gone up since, which is, I think, is something that a lot of people don't know about, but it's really a change in how we are behaving in America.
How should people think more about the layout of an area prior to moving there? What are your recommendations from what you've studied?
Well, I think what you're looking for is how easy it is to, for example, can your kids walk to school? Can you get a pint of milk without having to get into your car? So, you know, those basic things. Can you do, what can you do by walking or by biking? Can you see your neighbors on the streets? So those are basic questions that that a lot of people are asking themselves now when they choose a place to live.
Mm-hmm. And the cost of, the relative costs of all of this, is that a consideration?
Oh, that's a complicated question, because, you know, one of the things that happens is that, for example, in California, a lot of people lived out in exurbia because it was cheaper to buy houses out there.
Hmm.
What they didn't necessarily take into account is the cost of commuting to a job in the city. So
right.
They would be commuting 2 hours. One of the things that we have found in another study is that places that are much more auto-oriented, people are paying more for transportation. So there is a group in Chicago that has brought into play, instead of looking just at the cost of housing, you need to look at both housing and transportation costs in making decisions about where you live. I think that has really changed a lot of people's minds about how these decisions are being made.
But if you make the decision to live in a place where you walk more or can ride your bike more to do everyday errands, you can be healthier.
That is another upside to it, yes.
Upside. Okay, Dr. Norman Garrick, thanks for joining us today. Appreciate it.
It was my pleasure. Thank you very much.
Dr. Norman Garrick, he is the co-author of a study published in the Journal of Transport and Health that suggests that city living can improve your health. More Wellness Wednesday coming up. This is All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Cluster headaches are characterized by excruciating one-sided head pain, typically concentrated behind the eye and temple. And when I say excruciating, I mean their nickname is suicide headaches, and there has been little to no relief. But surgeons at the Ohio State University Wexner Medical Center could change that. They are the first in the United States to employ a certain treatment. And joining us now is OSU head and neck surgeon, Dr. Brad Liotto, to talk about it. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
I guess the first clue to the treatment is that it requires surgery instead of a pill, right?
That's correct. It's actually unique for me as an otolaryngologist or ear, nose, and throat surgeon, because cluster headache patients are a group of patients that I usually don't have a lot of contact with. So the opportunity to treat them with a surgical procedure opens up a whole new a realm for the patients and for the physicians treating them.
What has your experience been with patients who suffer from cluster headaches?
Well, I think the main experience that I notice, and again, I have probably a more limited exposure to these patients than a lot of neurologists have who treat a lot of headache disorders, is just the excruciating pain that they have. And when witnessing a cluster headache, you almost feel helpless because of the type of pain that they have and how severe it is. You almost feel helpless due to the fact that there aren't a lot of medications which work well all the time in treating the headache.
Now, just for folks out there who might be confused about what we're talking about, is this the same kind of headache as, say, trigeminal neuralgia?
No, it's a different type of headache, and this is a very specific type of headache. With respect to the study that we're doing, we're actually even doing the study on a very specific type of cluster headache patient. This is a patient who has cluster headaches most days without symptom-free periods of at least a month, and with headaches lasting at least a year in duration.
What causes them, do you know?
Nobody really knows, but this technology is actually aimed at basically breaking up the communication or disrupting the communication of a set of nerves that we think might be involved in the development of the headaches.
Describe the device you've used to treat these headaches. Tell us how it works.
Well, it's a new device. We're investigating its effectiveness, and that's the main goal of the study that we're performing at the Wexner Medical Center. And basically, it's a device that is called a stimulator. There's a small body of the stimulator that sits right under the cheekbone. And because of the location of where it sits, you almost can't even feel it with your tongue once we place it under the cheekbone. There's an electrode, which is, nothing more than a wire that passes back behind the maxillary or cheek sinus and sends a set of electrodes that sits back by this nerve control center. And what the patient does is actually holds up a remote controller, which looks kind of like a large cell phone. When they get a headache, they hold it up to their cheek, and that sends the signal to the stimulator, and basically a signal then back through that wire to the electrodes stimulates this ganglion or this nerve control center and hopefully breaks up the communication that led to the headache and hopefully treats the headache.
The stimulator, how big is it?
It's about the size of a dime or so, so pretty small. And like I said, it has no battery in it, and so that's what allows it to actually maintain a small size. Because of the location where we place the device, you really can't feel it even with your finger or your tongue once the incision heals.
It has no battery in it. How does it operate? What powers it?
Well, the main power comes from the remote controller. And so I think that there was a lot of good thought that went into designing it because the device is small. Again, you don't really feel it once it's placed in there. But also because since all of the energy comes to the remote controller, essentially your physician can actually control the energy source right in their office. And so once you have the device placed, you come into your neurologist, they talk to you about how your headaches have been, how well the device is working, and then they can adjust the parameters of the remote controller right there in their office.
Would that be something you would do or the physician?
No, interestingly, my role was somewhat limited because I'm involved in this study in making sure that they're appropriate for placement of the device. Then I place the device. I make sure that there weren't any postoperative complications. From there, we have our neurology team actually work with the patient to determine what the best settings are for their device.
How do you know what makes a good candidate for this study at this point?
Honestly, most of that work is done on the front end by our neurology team. Dr. Hussein is helping us in that endeavor. And there's a whole set of tests that they do and questionnaires to determine not only that patients have chronic cluster headaches, but also that they don't have any other problems or issues that would make them not a good candidate for the procedure.
My guest is Dr. Bradley Otto. He's a head and neck surgeon at the OSU Wexner Medical Center. We're talking about a new device that could treat what is called a cluster headache. It's very different from a tension headache or a migraine headache that most of us are familiar with. If you have a question or comment for Dr. Otto, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. As a surgeon, what do you do that prepares you to do this kind of a surgery?
There's nothing special that I do for this particular surgery because a lot of the maneuvers that I do are very similar to surgeries that we already perform in this area.
Like what?
Oh, like sinus surgery, for example. The place where this electrode actually ends up after we place it is very close to the sinonasal cavity. I also do skull-based surgery, so tumors in the sinuses and some small brain tumors that we actually approach through the nose. And also other sinus problems where I have to do open approaches and make incisions underneath the lip in order to address it. And so I'm comfortable in this area, and that's probably the main type of preparation I've done to place this device.
You said it's about the size of a dime. Where do you go through to place it, and what's it made of?
Sure. So it's made of a number of different parts. Some of them are proprietary, and basically it's
meaning you can't disclose them,
right? And they're small computer chips, which is the main body of the device. It sits under the cheekbone. There's a wire that sends electrodes back to the sphenopalatine ganglion, which is this nerve control center that we're stimulating, and it looks like any other set of wires you might encounter for other devices that you see. The incision that I make is underneath the lip, just in the side of the cheek. So if you feel your cheekbone just beneath there, underneath your lip, so there's no external incisions. The incision itself is about 2 centimeters long, and we use absorbable stitches after we place it, and so you don't even have to get stitches taken out after the procedure.
How many of these have you done now?
Well, we've only done one, so this trial just opened up.
Wow.
There has been some interest in it. As you can imagine, these patients suffer with this. It's a significant impact on their quality of life. And so since the news kind of broke that we had implanted this for our first patient, we've gotten several requests to basically for patients to be involved in the study.
Mm-hmm. So you haven't lined up everybody yet?
No, this is an ongoing study. We are the first site to do it, but in the end, there may be as many as 25 sites that enroll patients in this study.
And how many subjects do you want for this study? Is it open-ended at this point, or is there a minimum?
There's a minimum. We'd like to do at least 80 to 120 patients.
How common is this?
It's thought that about 0.2% or 1 in 500 patients, or 1 in 500 people, actually has cluster headaches. But if you look at patients with chronic cluster headaches, who this study is aimed at, they're only about 10% of that population. So it's pretty rare.
Are there any, given the location of the ganglion that you talked about, is there any connection? Because also there's a lot of sinus issues, watery eyes, drippy nose. It does seem to fall into your purview.
It does. I actually have an interest at some point in looking into this technology for other disorders. It is relatively new technology, and so we have to proceed with caution. And so now that we have FDA approval to treat patients with chronic cluster headache, this gives us an opportunity to take this group of patients who have a really debilitating disease and to study the safety and the effectiveness of the technology. And I think from there, there's potential for this technology to be used more widely down the road.
Can you give me some examples of what sort of ailments might hold promise for?
Well, I mean, one of the most obvious ones I think about are things potentially like migraine headache.
Okay.
This is another type of headache disorder that most people are more familiar with that potentially down the road this could be used for. But this is just somewhat thinking outside of the box at this point.
And how long did this just occur that you implanted this first one?
How long did it occur?
Yeah. Well, is it just been this week that you implanted?
Oh, yeah. We just did this last Wednesday.
Right. And so how's it gone so far?
He's done very well. He has minimal swelling on his cheek. He's noticed that he continues to have, so he has about anywhere from 2 to 4 cluster headaches a day. They last anywhere from 15 minutes to 3 hours for him, which is very characteristic for patients with cluster headaches. He's actually noticed that since the procedure, his cluster headaches happen just about as frequently, but they last for a shorter amount of time. However, he feels that sometimes they're a little bit more intense than what they were.
Hmm.
But there's a design to the study. Because we're doing trauma essentially in that area to place the device, any surgery you have, there's some degree of trauma that goes along with that. That's probably going to incite or give people more headaches in the initial steps. And that's why we have this period of time where we basically let everybody heal before we start changing the parameters on the device and actually start studying it. So in those patients, we actually have a 12-week waiting period before we actually start using the device.
I'm sorry, a 12-day?
12-week.
12-week waiting period, which would be a typical waiting period for surgery of this type.
For the most part, yeah.
When you talk about the ganglia, how close to them does the device go? Ganglia sounds like a tangle to me for some reason, so that's what I see in my mind, but I have no idea what you're actually talking about.
I think this is probably a good descriptor. It's basically a node along a nerve pathway,
okay.
And this node allows the nerves to communicate with one another. And so there's a thought that the autonomic nervous system, which is part of the nervous system that allows you to do things like tear or to have nasal congestion or runny nose, there's a thought that that nervous system interacts with the sensory nervous system in the face, so the nerves that give you sensation of touch, pain, and other things. There's a thought that by interrupting that communication center, that node, that you can actually basically get these headaches to stop. And that's the whole idea behind the technology. The device actually sits right adjacent to or right on the ganglion.
George, you're on the air. Hi, George.
And doctor, please allow me to ask if, in fact, your studies have allowed you to run down the path similar to what I saw in New York Times Magazine 6 or 8 weeks ago, having to do with rheumatoid arthritis, same concept that is being discussed here, being implemented in people not only in New York City, but in Western Europe.
Dr. Otto?
You know, I'm not familiar with the study on rheumatoid arthritis, so I apologize.
Are things like this being done in other countries, though?
Yeah, this is very similar study for this done in Europe. And if that's what he's getting at, yeah, there's actually a study done on about 32 patients in Europe. And they found that using this technology, that it was effective not only in treating the headaches, but they found that in some patients, they actually got fewer headaches the more they treated their headaches at that time. And so what they found over time is that there were a group of patients who not only found the device effective for treating headaches when they occur, but actually in preventing future headaches.
Is any part of this study associated with brain plasticity and the idea that maybe you wouldn't need this for the rest of your life, that it maybe could shape how the brain works?
I think that idea exists, but that's not the aim of this study.
Uh-huh.
And so you kind of alluded to that a little bit, and I did too, as I mentioned, that there are some patients that as they treat their active headaches, they tend to get less of them. And so I think there's this idea in mind that this could be occurring. We really don't know, though, until we do these studies. And this really is an initial study aimed at determining not only the effectiveness of it in treating the acute headache, but also determining its safety as well.
As far as what you did in the initial surgery, the first subject, was it a strange surgery for you, or did it incorporate enough of routine surgery for you that it wasn't difficult?
You know, anytime you're doing something new, there are some nuances that as you go along, you're going to pick up little things that maybe you don't even realize that you're doing differently that you are.
Uh-huh.
I wouldn't say this was a difficult dissection. I'm used to working in that area, but actually placing those small electrodes was something that was new and different. I've had training in doing it, and so it felt very similar to the training that we do, and I think it went quite smoothly. And so overall, I felt comfortable. But anytime you have a new technique, there is a bit of a learning curve.
And how long did it take?
The surgery, it took overall 2 hours.
Okay.
Actually, doing the dissection literally took only about 15 minutes. The rest of the time was spent making sure that those electrodes were in the best position possible so that once he heals up, the device will actually be effective or as effective as possible.
How can you see what you're doing in there?
Well, we use a combination of, you know, just looking at the wound with dissectors. We have co-surgeons that help with the dissection. But probably equally important, we actually have an x-ray that we use during the case that helps us to determine that the electrode is in the appropriate position.
So there aren't cameras or anything like that?
No, it's not like endoscopic sinus surgery, mainly because we're making that incision in the mouth. The problem with trying to use a scope in this area is that a lot of the tissue kind of falls back in your way, and so the scope actually sometimes makes it more difficult to see.
Gosh, I actually sort of understand what you're talking about. Dr. Otto, thank you so much for joining us today. Really appreciate it.
No problem. Thanks for having me.
Dr. Bradley Otto, he's an OSU Wexner Medical Center head and neck surgeon. Coming up, more Wellness Wednesday. This is All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Thank you. Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. The tragic suicide death of Robin Williams surprised many people, but at the age of 63, the gifted actor had plenty of problems that could be exacerbated by his longtime struggle with depression. But what about a three-year-old? A new study suggests that depression can affect all ages, even children as young as three, and that preschoolers, once diagnosed, are more than twice as likely to carry depression into adolescence. Joining us now by phone from Washington University in St. Louis is child psychiatrist and one of the study's authors, Dr. Joan Luby. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
This goes to the issue of depression as a chemical imbalance versus a reaction to a set of life circumstances, right?
Well, I mean, what we know about depression now is that it's actually a combination of both of those things. That depression is a disorder that it runs in families. We strongly believe that it has some genetic underpinnings, but it's also related to the number of stressful life experiences people encounter. So both of those factors are important.
All things being equal, how many stressful circumstances can a three-year-old have encountered?
Well, you know, three-year-olds can encounter stresses of a different nature. I mean, it depends upon what your developmental challenges are in terms of what you experience as a stress. So, in general, the children that we find that are depressed early in life, however, tend to it tends not to be a function of stressful life events at that early point. And I think what we believe that we've discovered is just a very early manifestation of, you know, the biological disorder.
How was the study conducted? How did you trust the reporting of a three-year-old?
Well, we trusted the reporting of the caregiver of the three-year-old. And we also did a number of other things to validate the disorder, such as observe the three-year-old in play in interaction with the caregiver. We have specialized types of techniques that we use where we give the three-year-old a story stem using play figures, and they complete the story. We also have then expanded our research program to look at things like stress reactivity, looking at hormones in the saliva, and then we've even gone on to do brain imaging in children this young.
Yeah, the brain imaging aspect of it is very interesting. What do you see? What are you looking for there?
Well, the questions we've been asking are whether the same alterations in brain that are known in depression in adults and adolescents can also be detected as early as age four. And the data that we've collected thus far suggests, one, that a depressed 4 to 6-year-old actually has some of the same functional alterations in the way they respond to negative stimuli as adult depressives. We also know that children who experience depression during the preschool period, when they undergo brain imaging at school age, also have the same alterations in terms of the structure, changes in the size of brain structures that are relevant to emotion processing, and changes in the connections between brain regions relevant to emotion processing.
This might be jumping ahead just a little bit, but is there any hope that by understanding this and seeing these patterns repeated in children as young as three, that those brain structures and those connections could be altered?
Well, that's not jumping ahead at all.
I mean,
that's really the primary thrust of this research. And, you know, you mentioned Robin Williams, a middle-aged man who suffered from chronic depression and then committed suicide. Of course, there are many, many, many people in our society who are afflicted with that problem and who ultimately suicide because of it. And, you know, one of the reasons for this is that we know depression is a chronic and relapsing disorder. And generally speaking, while it's a treatable disorder, it is a disorder that is difficult to treat in a subpopulation of depressed people. And for this reason, we're very interested in identifying it as early as possible in development so that we can intervene early, because interventions earlier in life are well known to be more robust and more effective during a period when the brain is rapidly developing and is more what we call neuroplastic or changeable.
You're listening to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. My guest is Dr. Joan Luby. She's a child psychiatrist and one of the authors of a study on depression in preschoolers. If you have a question or comment, you are welcome to give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. So you also evaluated children and their parents by viewing them through a two-way mirror. What was the significance of that?
Well, what we do is we view parent-child interactions through a two-way mirror, and we look at how supportive the parent is, how nurturing the parent is, how responsive or attuned the parent is to the child's emotions, and then we look at the child's pattern of emotion reactivity, their sort of emotion regulatory ability.
Can you give me an example of what would bring that out? What is it something a parent would do, like pick up a book and show them a book? Or what would a
parent
be doing?
Well, a lot of these parent-child interactions actually involve mild stressors, because what we want to do is we want to exert a mild stress or pressor on the dyad to bring out an interaction where the child is in need of regulatory. They need to utilize their own internal regulatory capabilities, and they need to utilize the support of the parent. So one example that has been frequently written about is a task where the child and parent are seated in the room. There's an attractively wrapped gift that is for the child, but they're told that they can't open it until the parent is done completing their paperwork.
Oh, boy.
And of course, yeah, you can imagine. So for most preschoolers, that's a very, very difficult experience that they have to wait. They want to open the gift. They're impatient. And one of the things we look at is both how the child copes with that and then how the parent copes with it. And it's a good recapitulation of, you know, common life events where mom is cooking dinner and the child's in need of her help and attention, and just how that's managed tends to be very representative of daily interactions.
Where do you get your subjects from? How do you find them? What qualifies them?
So in this particular study, we screened children in the St. Louis metropolitan area from daycares, preschools, and pediatrician's office using a screening checklist that's a very brief 18-item checklist that can be answered by the parent in about 2 to 3 minutes. And children who are over a certain number of symptoms on that screening checklist then were recruited into the study and underwent much more comprehensive assessments.
Teresa in Grove City, you are on the air with Dr. Joan Luby. Hi, Teresa.
Hi there. How are you, girls?
Fine, thanks.
Okay, so I just wanted to remind people, because I have 3 children and they're very unique and different, and they've experienced early childhood trauma, and that can also come through and affect the brain development, maybe even displaying signs of ADHD, or in this case, we're talking about depression. We were talking about children 3 and older, but certainly, you know, besides life stressors, any child that's experienced any kind of traumatic event, the loss of a parent, a move, or loss of friends, it can affect their brain in different ways that way as well.
Dr. Luby?
I think Teresa makes a very, very good point. I mean, one of the things that's really important to understand that a lot of the developmental research that's been done over the past 2 decades has really uncovered is that young children are very, very emotionally and cognitively aware of their environment. That many people used to assume that if children were young or infants, you know, that things happened in the environment and that it didn't have any impact on them or that they weren't aware of it. And we know this is not the case, that in fact, children are very reactive and very sensitive, which is one of the reasons why it is so important for us to be very attentive to the emotional and learning environment in early childhood.
Thanks a lot, Teresa, for that call. If anybody else has a question, there's still time, 614-292-8513. It seems like we already have a stigma in our society about depression. It's getting better, thank goodness. But are parents hesitant to enroll their children in a study like this when they don't really want to, maybe they don't buy into what you're studying?
Mm-hmm. Well, it's true that there is a stigma, and it is getting better. We're conducting a couple of studies. In this particular study, we don't necessarily sort of advertise that the study is about depression, because it's really more about emotion development.
Mm-hmm.
And we don't really make diagnoses of children either, because we're, you know, we're investigating the area. Although, obviously, if we encounter children who are in need of help, we refer them. But the other thing that's important is that we've really started to understand depression as a disorder of emotion development. And it's the idea that children who are depressed, and even adults who are depressed, have alterations in the way they cope with emotions, the way they process emotions, the way they react to things in the environment. I think when we understand the disorder in this way, it gives us an opportunity to destigmatize it and to intervene in a developmental way that is really more effective and more acceptable in our society.
I wanted to ask you about the interventions. What kind of interventions are you talking about? Medication?
So that's an important point. And right now we're actually conducting a large-scale intervention study. And no, medications are not the intervention that we're studying. We're studying parent-child psychotherapy that, along the lines of what I just talked about, is really focused on enhancing the child's emotion development, really teaching the child to be more emotionally competent, to be more aware of their emotions, to develop better skills in terms of how to regulate their emotions, and to help coach the parent to be a better external emotion regulator for the child. So the therapy is really developmental in origin. It's a psychotherapeutic intervention that involves working with the parent and child together.
We have an email from Anne who asks, has anyone looked at teaching kids to meditate to change their brains?
People have looked at that, and there's a big emphasis now on mindfulness interventions, which are sort of fundamentally have meditative elements to them. You know, once you get into very young children, that becomes a bit more challenging, but certainly those techniques are used in school-aged kids and adolescents, yes.
What are some warning signs that a child may be depressed? What are you seeing?
So that's a good question, too, because it is something that's often missed by parents or primary care doctors or teachers, because depression is what we call an internalizing disorder, a disorder that children are not necessarily disruptive to their environments when they're depressed. So things that are very important to look for are young children who are less joyful, because it is normative to be joyful as a preschooler. So kids who don't seem to enjoy activities and play, they're socially withdrawn, they're uninterested in engaging in activities and play that they used to enjoy. Another very specific symptom is the symptom of excessive guilt. So young children who feel guilty when they've done something wrong and they're unable to get over the guilt, or they even feel guilty for things that they aren't responsible for.
Why is that? Where does that guilt come from? Why is that an indicator of depression?
Well, guilt is one of the symptoms of depression, and many depressed individuals ruminate and feel very guilty about things. It's sort of a negative sort of self-attribution, self-blame. So it's a feature of the disorder. And we actually know that there are brain correlates to experiences of excessive guilt. We have another paper that we've published that shows that sort of a smaller size of a key brain region called the insula is associated with this early experience of guilt, and that predicts the occurrence of later episodes of depression.
If you take your child to the doctor and determine that he or she is depressed, or how would you do that? If you think your child may be depressed, is the first trip to your pediatrician?
It might be. It depends on just how attentive your pediatrician is to mental health problems. Some pediatricians are very attentive and will readily refer. Other pediatricians are still harboring old ideas that, you know, preschool children are too young to have mental disorders, or that they'll grow out of it. And we really know from scientific studies that that's not the case. The other option would be just to directly seek a mental health professional, a social worker, psychologist, child psychiatrist.
And when you're talking about interventions, they would differ based on the child, or are, would there be sort of, are there boilerplate type of interventions when you're talking about them at that age?
Well, that's one of the problems. This is a very, very new area. Mm. So really, we haven't understood that depression was a valid disorder in children younger than six until about 10 to 15 years ago. So it's just gaining wide acceptance in the clinical community. And because of that, there are very, very few studies that address treatment. I believe ours is one of the first sort of treatments that is developmentally appropriate and specifically designed to treat depression, and we're currently just now testing it in a large-scale randomized controlled trial. So unfortunately, there are not a lot of known effective treatments available at this time, and that's an area of burgeoning research.
And even if there, even as those emerge, there probably it's going to be another lag period before there are people out there qualified to pursue them.
Yes, I think that's probably true.
There's always a shortage of child psychologists.
There is.
What about that issue?
Well, I think as we develop more effective treatments, and early interventions are an area that are rapidly being studied. Those treatments can be disseminated. Also, mental health clinicians can have a wide variety of training and subspecialty. They can be social workers, they can be psychologists or psychiatrists. So I think it's possible for broader dissemination when we broaden the net of people who can actually administer the treatment. The treatment we're testing right now is designed to be administered by master's level clinicians. So if in fact it proves to be effective, it also is highly cost effective.
Hmm. And the less joyful, excessive guilt, indications of possible depression in a child, how do those differ? Are those pretty much the same things as you look for in adults or adolescents? Or do they manifest differently? Does depression manifest necessarily differently in a very young child?
Well, that's a good question. Basically, fundamentally, the core symptoms of depression are the same across the lifespan. The way they manifest, however, are somewhat different. So because decreased joyfulness would be a symptom in a preschooler, whereas that wouldn't be a symptom in an adolescent who may be sort of brooding more normatively.
Mm-hmm.
Decreased libido, obviously, is a symptom of what we call anhedonia in an adult. Obviously, that's not going to be manifest in a preschooler. Instead, they're going to have decreased ability to enjoy activities and play. So there are developmental adjustments in terms of how these core symptoms present themselves.
And also, with adults and maybe to a certain extent adolescents, but they learn to cloak it too.
Yes. That's true, and that's another reason why I think it's very important to try to identify it early, because it's a bit more straightforward. Everything is with younger children,
right? And I get it brings up again the issue of someone like Robin Williams, who everyone perceived as very not everyone, but who many people perceived as very joyful.
That's true. Yeah, that's true, and which just shows his interior life and his exterior presentation were very different.
Is there anything that surprised you about your findings? Is there a lot more kids out there that you're concerned about? What's the takeaway on that level?
Well, our findings don't suggest that the prevalence rate of the disorder is startlingly high. In fact,
okay.
The prevalence rate of the disorder in preschool children looks to be about the same as it is in school-age children, which is about 1% to 2%. Prevalence rates of the disorder are thought to go up in girls, specifically in adolescents.
Mm.
But the robustness of the findings did surprise even me, just in terms of the brain findings and how these alterations in brain are evident even at this early point in life, and that they're still detectable at school age and early adolescence, even after the episode of depression, it has resolved itself. So it really underscores the importance of identifying this early.
Well, Dr. Joan Luby, thanks for talking with us today about it.
Thanks for having me.
Dr. Joan Luby, she's a child psychiatrist and one of the authors of a new study on depression in preschoolers. Thanks for listening to Wellness Wednesday today. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.